Man is by nature inquisitive. From time immemorial, mankind has progressed because of this desire to know. To know why the sun rises in the east, the ancient man probably wondered why the rain falls, why does the rainbow come out, why do the seasons change. And to that extent, the progress of civilization, the march of civilization went on. When Galileo saw the apple, Newton, when he saw the apple falling from the tree, he went around asking everybody, why did the apple fall down? Why didn't it go up? And everybody in the village, he would ask, why did the apple fall? And they told him, what is it? What is your problem? Since time immemorial, apples have been falling. From the tree, they fall down. Your father had it, your grandfather had it, your great-grand. And now why do you want to know? Why don't you just eat the apple? It's a nice red apple. Eat and go on. Why are you wasting your time and my time? When Galileo and Copernicus were searching for the movement of the stars and the planets, and they were persecuted by the church because they came to the conclusion that the earth is not the center of the universe and all the stars and planets do not revolve around us. There was the march of knowledge when Marie Curie, the Polish scientist who was the Nobel Prize winner in physics and chemistry, discovered new atoms and new molecules like radon and palladium. It was to advance this progress of knowledge. So we find that throughout history, when Einstein wanted to know the meaning of space and time and relativity, so knowledge is the insatiable desire for human beings, and all scientific progress has accompanied through the usage of instruments, through the usage of microscope and telescope and all binoculars and all of these to advance science. But the ancient rishis, the seers of thousands of years ago, did not have any telescopes or microscopes, did not have any scientific instruments as we know them to calibrate any of these calipers and all. But through meditation, through going inward, through becoming one with that supreme consciousness, they were able to trace the march of events all the way back to when the earth was first created, how it emerged from that infinite consciousness. They were able to describe laws of physics and the movement of the stars and planets, which are very well described in our scriptures of thousands of years ago, very, very scientifically. They were able to come up with laws of grammar and physics and mathematics. They were able to determine the physiological functions of the body, all without any modern instruments. They talked about the digestive system, the respiratory, the cardiovascular, how they work. If you read the Prashna Upanishad, it's a very beautiful Upanishad, very short. But the special thing about it is that in that, it's a textbook of anatomy, more than an Upanishad. Of course, it comes, teaches us, takes us to the highest truth. But in it, they have dissected the human body, all the layers and all the So we can see that knowledge has from time immemorial led man towards higher, towards the progress. And the knowledge progressed in a stepwise progression. It's not a haphazard growth of knowledge. I want to sit down and, you know, study, or I want to love somebody, or I want to have compassion, but my body hurts. I have severe pain in my back. I have a severe headache. And they say, you know, you need to go out and serve the world. You need to love everybody. But my emotional personality cannot develop until my physical comforts are taken care of. That's why they say, Bhuke bhajan na hoye Gopala. It says, oh Lord, Gopala, oh Krishna, I cannot remember you as long as my stomach is empty. Because when my stomach is empty, I want to fill that first. So man has to fulfill their physical needs first. And then they say, go to the emotional needs. You must love and you must have compassion and kindness. So that's how you can progress. But then they say, you must go to the intellectual. You must have the right idea. But he says, I am unhappy. You know, somebody close to me died, or my beloved left me, or my heart is broken. And I don't have time to study the Upanishads, to read science, to read mathematics. So a person has to be emotionally contented, emotionally happy for spiritual or even intellectual knowledge, even to study science and chemistry. And then a person has to be intellectually satisfied. All his intellectual curiosity has to be satisfied before he turns his mind to the higher, to the self or the consciousness. Because we all have this curiosity to know. And so that's why we go to a teacher and we learn the Upanishads, learn the Gita, like Swamiji, we heard from him, the chapter 16. So having heard from the teacher, then the desire comes, okay, now I need to know. I need to go beyond just the body, mind, and intellect. I need to go beyond my physical needs and my emotional comforts. So I have to go beyond my physical needs and my emotional needs and my intellectual needs to go beyond the higher. So it's a stepwise progression. And in that, the teachers say that some element of vairagya or dispassion is necessary. We cannot spend our whole life just worrying about objects, emotions, and thoughts, and taking care of my body, mind, and intellect. I have to detach myself to turn my attention to the higher. As long as you're just involved in the world in accumulating, acquiring, possessing, reaching, getting, your mind will never turn to the higher. And that's why they say that one's life cannot only be spent in just physical pursuits, you know, getting love, getting physical comforts, getting, acquiring more and more, getting one PhD, second PhD, one MD, on and on and on. You cannot. There has to be a standstill, and you say, okay, now I have done it. Now I need to study something higher. Vairagya also comes to some people very, very violently, very strongly. Some people gradually progress, okay, from physical to mental to intellectual to the spiritual. But then there are others to whom this vairagya comes violently. They go through a major problem in their life, a major crisis, maybe a death or a separation, or some major physical illness. You know, people who have had this near-death experiences where they had almost died and had a cardiac arrest and then they are revived. It changes their whole life. Or somebody has been totally disillusioned in love and is crying and is miserable. And then such a person goes to the temple or the church asking for solace. And then his mind starts, enough of this world. This world is giving me too much sorrow. There is that. But that's what happens. You know, you get detachment because of sorrow. And so that's what happened to Arjuna. That's why they say the Bhagavad Gita is a storehouse of knowledge. Because when he was faced in the battlefield, where he was on the side of the good, he was on the side of the Pandavas who were the good, and they had to face their evil cousins, the Kauravas, who were corrupt and dishonest and murderous and did everything lying and cheating. And they had acquired, taken, stolen the kingdom from the Pandavas by cheating. And the Pandavas had to fight not only for their own personal kingdom, but for the benefit of the whole country. Because who would you rather have them rule? The corrupt or the good? But when Arjuna was ready for the battle, he had his arms and he had his weapons, and then Krishna, you know, took him his chariot between the two armies, as you can see here. He's standing between the two armies, the good and the evil, and then his mind suddenly wavers because he says, what am I doing? You know, I'm going to fight this battle against my own cousins, and I have to shoot arrows at my grandfather, who was also on the side of the wrong. And my teacher, Dronacharya, who taught me, held my hand and taught me to shoot bow and arrow. And of course, in Hindu culture, a guru or a teacher is respected. But they happened to be on the wrong side. They had all chosen the wrong side. And he said, I cannot do that. Plus, this war is going to result in so much destruction. And so he was shattered. He was mentally destroyed. And he was just, he said, my hand is shaking and my hair is on end. And he was almost, tears were running down his cheek. And his tears were running down his cheeks. And he sat down at the bottom of the chariot and said, I shall not fight. I can't. Now, Krishna had two choices. Being God, he could have changed the environment. He could have said, okay, you know, by magic, I'll make sure all the Pandavas get destroyed and you guys all have the kingdom. But that would not have served the purpose. Because similarly, in our life also, when we are faced with problems, we go to the guru or we go to the Lord and say, oh Lord, you know, please, you know, fix my husband. He gives me too many problems, or my child, or my boss, or my neighbor, or my friend. So we ask him to fix the stock market so it may continue to go up. So we ask the Lord or the guru to fix the situations. We fix the circumstances. But the Bhagavad Gita says you do not need to change the situations. You change yourself. When you change, the world will change around you. Even if the world does not change, even if the circumstances do not change drastically, it will improve your ability to handle lives. You know, that's why throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sama shatrau cha mitre cha tatha man apamana yoho shitoshna sukha dukheshu sama sanga vivarjitaha. He says, who is the wise person? Who is sama? Who is balanced in joys and sorrows, in success and failure, in heat and cold, in sickness and health? Because these will come to everybody. There is nobody in this world who will not have joys and sorrows, who will not have ill health or good health, who will not have success and failure, who will not have insult and praise. Tulya ninda stutir mauni. So these qualities are of a wise person who can withstand life's problems, irrespective of what arrows or what problems man throws at it, or what the circumstances throw at it. Gurudev says in one place, he says, without spiritual stamina, a human being cannot withstand all the blows of circumstances, all the problems that come. It's only through spiritual stamina that you can develop this strength to withstand, to accomplish. And so that what Krishna does to him. Krishna does not change the situations. He does not suddenly make the Kauravas into good people. He does not do anything. Everything is the same. He works on Krishna, on Arjuna's mind, on the student's mind. And that's what this knowledge does to us, gives us mental strength and mental clarity so that any problem of the world will not affect us. So this treatment, this Krishna treatment that is given to Arjuna is a very gradual progress. When I first started studying Bhagavad Gita many years ago, I used to think, isme kuch wo logic nahi. There is no logic. There is no connection. One chapter, second chapter doesn't make any sense. How little I knew in those days. Because as you study the Bhagavad Gita, you realize that it's a very logical progression of ideas. So in the first chapter, we see the Arjuna disease, where Arjuna is shattered, he's devastated. And in the second chapter, then Krishna starts the treatment. It's a psychological treatment, like a very expert psychologist. He works on Arjuna's mind. And in the first few verses of the second chapter, he tells him his duty. Why he should do what he's supposed to do. What is his sorrow? And why does he think that he is killing? And he tells him that there is no death, that the soul is immortal, and that's what we really are. So even the highest knowledge he throws at him right off the bat, because he wants Arjuna to wake up. And at times he even calls him, you know, weakling, calls him a coward and all that. To treat him, sometimes a doctor has to give bitter medicine for a patient to get well. And then slowly through the second chapter, like a beautiful orator, like any good orator, if you watch him speak, say he's going to speak for an hour, what does he do? The first 5 minutes he will introduce, okay, today I'm going to talk about quantum physics. And so in the first 5 minutes he will introduce his talk. Then for the next 50 minutes, he will speak. And then in the last 5 minutes, he'll say, okay, now, today, what have we heard? Therefore, and then he will summarize. So similarly, Shri Krishna in the second chapter introduces the Bhagavad Gita. That's why the second and the 18th chapter are the longest, because in the second chapter, he gives us the entire introduction to the entire Bhagavad Gita, the path of karma, the path of knowledge, the path of action, the path of devotion. Everything is summarized in the second chapter, and also the sthita prajna lakshanani, the characteristics of a wise person. Because Arjuna asks him, sthita prajnasya ka bhasha samadhi stasta keshava. He says, what are the characteristics of a wise person? A person whom you said has gone beyond all these. And so Shri Krishna very beautifully gives him the characteristics of a wise person, so that those verses are some that we can all aim for those. That, okay, this is how I should be. You know, this is how I am, and this is how I need to go. And so the knowledge is given to him very beautifully in the second chapter, talking about knowledge. There was this old lady who was called as a witness in a courtroom. And so she's there to testify as a witness. And so the prosecution attorney asks her, do you know me? So he said, I know you very well. You are a bigoted, lying, cheating lawyer. You have 3 wives. You cheated on all of them. And you were a useless student, and I knew you never would accomplish anything. And all you have become is a paper pusher. I'm even surprised you have a job in this, you know, in this courtroom, in this county. So he gets immediately, you know. So then the defense attorney asks, his client was a doctor. Do you know my client? Oh, this doctor, this surgeon, I know him. He's a butcher. He has killed so many patients. He has had all kinds of affairs. He is so dishonest. I'm surprised he has not been investigated by the board. I'm surprised he's being sued for the first time. I know him very well. So then the judge calls the 2 lawyers to him and he whispers, if any of you rascals ask sir if he knows me, I will try you for contempt of court. I'll put you in jail. So she had the right knowledge. So that was Krishna's goal, to give Arjuna the knowledge of what is my goal in life, what is my purpose. And so then from the second chapter, the teaching starts. And it's a very beautiful progression. As you study the Bhagavad Gita, what I'm just trying to do is summarize a little bit for the new people as to what we have covered so far. So in the third chapter, I think to me is the most practical, is a wonderful chapter, because it talks about karma yoga. Because we are all in this world to work. You know, we are all working, whatever, whether you're a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer or teacher or a housewife or a student. We are all doing some work or the other. So the work I am doing, how I should do it, with what attitude, how I should dedicate the work to the Lord, surrender it to him, and while I'm doing the work, do not focus upon the result. Do what is right, and the result will take care of itself. So that is very beautifully explained in the third chapter. Of course, there is a lot more, but I just have to give little highlights, and then of course I would encourage you all to read on your own. In the fourth chapter, then he advances the student to working for all. Initially, okay, I'm doing for myself, my family, my children, and I'm doing it with the right attitude. But then he says, you have to now work with the yagna spirit, where in the olden days, where the yagnas used to be there, there were these big festivals, religious festivals, where the whole village would gather, and there would be a fire kund, like a place where the fire would be lit, and everybody would participate. Somebody would clean that place, or somebody would build that little yagnashala. Somebody would bring milk, or bring firewood, or bring offerings to put in the fire, bring ghee. Somebody else would provide food. Okay, I'm going to feed all. So everybody participated in this spiritual activity that was done for the benefit of the whole community, whether it was for rain or whether it was for the good of all. And so this yajna spirit Krishna extends to not only this religious activities, but all activities that you do. It should be done with an idea of service to the community. So like when we get together, and you get together and build a hospital or build a church, or when we built this Chinmaya mission, we saw the yajna spirit where people get together, sink their individual differences and work for the benefit of all. Then Krishna in the fifth, he takes him one step higher. He says you have to give up the sense of doership, karma sannyasa yoga. Because it's very clear that when you do a lot, say you do a lot for the service of others and you benefit others, then a little ego comes in there. I am the greatest servant of the Lord. There has never been a greater social worker than I am. And so he says that give up the sense of doership, the sense of ownership, that I am that, dedicate everything, karma sannyas, give up everything, dedicate it to the Lord. And so having prepared the student with the right attitude and the right activity, then he says, now I need to take it up a notch higher. And so from the sixth chapter, he then tells the student how to go higher, go one step higher to the technique of meditation. And that's why the sixth chapter is called Dhyana Yoga, or the path of meditation, where he then tells the student how to quieten the mind, how to sit in the right posture, and every detail is given. You know, what kind of seat you should have, what kind of surroundings, and then how to sit down and meditate, the technique of meditation, why I should meditate, what are the benefits of meditation, what are the results of meditation, how, where will it take you, what are the obstacles that come. Everything is answered in the sixth chapter. Not only that, but also in the sixth chapter towards the end, Arjuna asks him that what happens to a person who does not reach the highest and gives up his life. So he also tells him that about the path of reincarnation and rebirth. Nahi kalyana kaschit tat, O child, never any person will suffer. Whatever you have reached, wherever you have gone, even if you give up the life, that is not wasted. You continue your spiritual journey, as Swamiji also told us. Your physical and material things will not go with you, your money or your body or your, but whatever spiritual progress you have made, that's why they say that the only thing you can carry with you to the other world is karmas. Your karmas, your actions, and your spiritual progress. Wherever you have reached, next life, you will continue. He says he will be born in the house of yogis if he has progressed. Next life, he will be born in the house of yogis, but he can continue. So then the sixth chapter having finished, Krishna then tells him that I have to teach him the Upanishads, because the Upanishads are the highest knowledge. And actually they say the Upanishad to study, one has to go to a teacher, one has to be mentally prepared, one has to be in a very quiet, peaceful atmosphere, like in the olden days. The teachers would be living in the forest or up in the mountains, and the students would approach them and would approach them with humility. Panipado, he says, with humility, having given up all the worldly attachments. So nothing else is important. I want the highest knowledge. So the student approaches the teacher with ultimate humility. That's why the word Upanishad, Upa means near, Ni means below, Shad means sit. So student has to come near a teacher and sit below. That idea being that there has to be a sense of humility, a sense, that's why we prostrate to the teacher. So this knowledge of the Upanishads, which was given in the caves and the Himalayas and in the river banks, is now given to Arjuna right in the middle of the battlefield where all this noise is going on and all this. But Krishna does it in a very simple way. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, the 7th, 8th and 9th chapters are the essence of the knowledge. In the 7th, it's very beautifully described. They call it Jnana Vijnana Yoga. So that means knowledge and wisdom. See, we think that they are both the same, knowledge and wisdom, but they are different. Knowledge is what I acquire from this college or from the school or from reading books or from my worldly experiences. But when does that become wisdom? When that knowledge becomes my own. The other thing they say that wisdom is the spiritual knowledge. Then only when that knowledge takes you to the higher, then only you can call it wisdom. So that's why he teaches him jnana vijnana. How from knowledge to go to wisdom, how from worldly knowledge to go to the highest. And the eighth beautiful chapter is about the imperishable Brahman, Akshar Brahma Yoga. Akshar Brahma, that he says there is one imperishable, all-pervading, ever-present Brahman consciousness that you can call Allah, you can call Father in heaven, you can call the substratum of the universe. And that cannot be seen, cannot be heard, cannot be tasted, cannot be spoken of, cannot be described, cannot be explained, cannot be understood. You say, well, if that is the case, then what is the use of the teacher and what is the use of the books? But they say that through the right knowledge and through the right understanding, you can turn your attention inward where the Lord's presence is, and that one Brahman is there in all beings. So universal love, universal kindness, and also the attitude of gratitude and devotion develops, because, oh Lord, you are that consciousness who is the creator of everything, and whatever I have, everything is yours, everything is given to you by me, And also it talks very beautifully about the entire creation, how the Brahman alone was, and then how at the dawn of creation the world emerged, and then Sargeya, and at the end how the Pralaya comes, where the end of the, everything is beautifully described in the eighth chapter. Then I think the ninth is the toughest chapter, in my opinion, is the hardest chapter, and Krishna there, right in the beginning of the chapter, he says, Matsthani Sarva Bhutani, Chaham Teshvavasthitaha. He says, all these beings you see, they are in me, but I am not in them. What? The beings are in me, but I am not in them? What are you speaking? But then Krishna explains to him that I am the substratum, I am the support, everything emerges from me, but I am not involved in the ups and downs, like the consciousness. That is not affected. If the body is getting healthy or unhealthy, the mind is sorrowful or joyful, or the intellect is being praised or insulted, the consciousness in me is the same. It's always present, ever was, ever is. Like the ocean. The ocean remains the same. The waves may be born and die. Thousands of waves are being born and dying. But the ocean is the source of all the waves, but the ocean is not involved in the birth and death of the waves. The ocean does not start clapping when few waves are being born and doesn't start crying when the waves are dying. He said that is the nature of the world. Waves will be born and waves will die. People will come and people will go. Joys and sorrows. He supports everything, but himself is not affected by it. So that is the and of course there is a lot more in the ninth chapter. That's why it's called Raja Guhyam. It is called the secret knowledge. Secret does not mean that it should not be shared. Secret means you need a teacher to explain it to you. And so having understood, the Arjuna says, okay, you say that the world has come from you, but you are not in it. Okay, tell me, where are you in the world? See, Arjuna is a very intelligent teacher, a student, where he's not just blindly accepting with blind faith. He questions, he doubts, and he says, I need the proof. And so in the 10th chapter, he tells Krishna, tell me where you are in this universe. Oh Lord, okay, I accept that you are the Lord of the universe. Little bit I am accepting. I'm not sure yet. I think you may be, but show me where you are. So Krishna tells him, I am the, among the mountains, I am the Himalayas. Among the birds, I am the eagle. Among the waters, I am the ocean. Among the rivers, I am the Ganges. Among the people, I am the king. Among the animals, I am the lion. And so trying to tell him that wherever you see anything beautiful, glorious, I am there. So that is the beauty of the 10th chapter, where day-to-day activities, how I can see the Lord, it makes it very clear. Arjuna, then his demands are not satisfied. He says, you told me that the whole world is in you. Okay, show it to me. I don't believe you. I want to see it myself. He says, drashtum ichhami te rupam aishwaram purushottama. O purushottama, O highest form, I want to see that form. You say you are the support of everything. I want to see it. And then he says, you know, then he becomes a little manyase yadi tat shakyo maya drashtum iti prabho. Then he says, oh, I'm sorry if my tone was demanding. If you think I am worthy of it, please show it to me. And so Krishna, in his infinite compassion, shows him this divine form, where you can see Arjuna and Krishna at the bottom, and then the huge form of the Lord, where the whole universe, of course, this is an artist depiction, but Arjuna sees the whole universe, the past, present, and future, even the gods in heaven, even the demons, even the ghosts, goblins, snakes, everything he sees, all the humans. Not only that, but he sees what is going to happen in the future, everything. So now he is convinced. Okay, teacher, now I am totally convinced. So then he asks a beautiful question, which we will do in the first verse. But in response to that one question, you know, the first verse is Arjuna's question, and then the 19 verses are Krishna's answer. But Gurudev Swami Chinmayananda says that the 12th chapter is a perfect thesis on the theory of devotion. If you want to know about devotion or love for God, there is nothing else you need to know. These 19 verses, if you understand, you can develop true devotion for the Lord. And he also says that these verses are so perfect that if you remove one of them, it will change the whole meaning. Or if you add another one, it will make it redundant. And just as Mona Lisa, if you see that painting by Leonardo da Vinci, it is so perfect that if he had added anything or taken away anything, it would have taken away the beauty of that picture. So that's the beauty of this 12th chapter, that there is nothing about devotion that is not covered. Of course, there are more elaborate texts, like there is Narad Bhakti Sutra, which I had the good fortune to read, and that covers it beautifully. But there are more elaborate, but if you want it in one place, in a simple text, this is it. So that is the glory of this chapter. That is the beauty of this chapter that we are going to undertake. The reason I had this elaborate introduction, because one has to have a little devotion that what am I about to study and why am I going to study it and how is it going to benefit me. So that is my brief introduction, more than brief. It's about a 30-minute introduction to the 12th chapter, but I'd like to pause here, and if anybody has any questions or comments, anything. Actually, Hansa always tells the story about those two angels, where the one said that I'll become a good angel, and the other one says I'll become evil so that your goodness will shine. So the idea being that, of course, the reason people are evil, or reason people are corrupt, or reason it's because of their vastness, because of their selfish tendencies. And if some of, say, I really, really, really wanted to use drugs, and I couldn't do it in this lifetime, I had this strong craving, or maybe it was only partially fulfilled, and then I died, or I got arrested, and I got, then I couldn't fulfill it. So then that desire carries, if the desire is strong enough, it will carry into my next life, where I'll become a drug addict or a user. And then also, because of all those negative tendencies, I'm performing negative karmas. And it also could be that some of the people whom I am hurting, maybe they had hurt me. You don't know. It's so complex. Somebody had hurt me, and so there is some, residual give and take. But the point of the matter is that such people who are at the lowest level of human endeavor, Gurudev calls them tamasic people, or the lowest, they then have to go through the sufferings of fate to evolve. So that's what they say, that they will maybe put in jail or get punished or the fate will punish them, their own actions, they'll get, diseases and illnesses and, from all that. or they will get so much mental anguish that having gone through the sufferings of their negative actions, they then slowly evolve from tamas to rajas, where you start working, but you are working selfishly. Yes. True. Yeah, well, the mother, there are two reasons. One is that she gives her a chance to evolve, to become a better. Also, there are some karma she has done in her past life. So by having a child like that and going through the suffering, she is paying for those karma. So there are both ways. And a wise person is the one who sees the sorrows and evolves and becomes better and becomes stronger. But there are others who, when they go through this sorrow, they become so disillusioned and they become so dejected and they go into depression and they blame God and they blame society. So that's what Eckhart Tolle calls them alarm clocks. You know, where either you can wake up and become a better person through the sorrow. The alarm clock is like a hard blow, you know, like a loud clang. So that God sends you these alarm clocks. Either you wake up and become a better person, or you continue to suffer and become more and more and more miserable. So that's the Lord's way of giving them an opportunity to improve, I think. Yes. No, no, it's not for his entertainment. What God did was he created animals, birds, and fish. And he put them instinct. Okay, a dog has to act like a dog. A lion has to act like a lion. Lion cannot say, I'm going to love all the deer and, you know, become a loving lion. A big fish will eat a small fish. So they work on instinct. But man was given an intellect, was given an intelligence, and given the freedom to choose. That's why in the Bible, even the first two children of Adam and Eve, Abel and Cain, one of them killed the other. Now, they were born pure. They were born of the same parents, Adam and Eve. They were both pure, but one turned out to be a murderer and killed his brother. So the difference between a fish and a human is that a human has the ability to choose. And so what God did was he's a democracy. He's a complete 100% democracy. He says, I don't do anything. I just create. I make the circumstances available. And then I give you freedom to choose. And then your choice is whether you make good or bad choices. And so depending on, so the humans then, say there were two or three humans, and one was, you know, all were equal, and one says, I want to become more than this guy. He has two cows, I'm going to get three cows or four cows. So he starts by stealing the neighbor's cow or by beating him up and killing him to get his cows. So all these human tendencies developed because of this attitude of, you know, selfishness, ego, competition, jealousy. They developed in humans as time went by, as the society gets more crowded. We find that nowadays competition is much worse, as when people were living in the forest and, you know, food was plenty and, you know, the air was good. And now, of course, there is pollution, there is crime. People are having alarms, you know, in their homes. Why? Because of break-ins. So humans were the only species that he gave us the freedom to choose. And then, of course, he sent the prophets. He sent his son as Jesus. He sent, you know, Krishna himself came as Krishna. He sent Swami Chinmayananda and Shankaracharya and Guru Nanak and Buddha and all these great saints and prophets to give us the right knowledge. And that's how the Gita and the Upanishads and the Bible and everything was composed. So he gave us the right knowledge, but he gave us freedom to choose. So the problems that are in this world are not of God's making, they are of man's making. Until man came, this earth was the Garden of Eden. Everything was perfect. And so when we came, of course, we did good also. You know, we did good to this earth, but we also did bad. So whatever I am suffering is because of my karmas. It is not because of his doing. He is a total democrat. He says, I give you total freedom. Do whatever you want. And then, like Swamiji spoke last week, he put a little V-chip in us, the chip that carries all my data. If I did good, okay, good. If I do bad, bad. So that data is accumulated in me, and I carry that with me. And that's why I suffer. So it's not his entertainment or anything. I mean, he created the world that he said, I am one, let me become many. But then he said, let me do a unique experiment. Let me create man. In fact, in one of the Upanishads, he says that when God created man, he was very happy because he said, wow, I've created a beautiful creature. who can think, who can do great achievements, you know, great scientific achievements, and also can realize God. See, man is the only species in where you can realize, even as a devtas, even the gods in heavens. Last 2 weeks ago, we had talked about deva apyasya rupasya nityam darshana kangshina. Even the gods in heaven cannot realize. To realize the truth, they have to be born as humans and to go to a teacher and study. So human is a great species. We have this great opportunity with this knowledge and with this book called the Bhagavad Gita and all the teachings of the... So they say, do not waste this opportunity. Use it to learn the truth. So that is the purpose of creation.
Well, maybe, but it's different. Maybe it's people. I just thought
yeah, well, you know, a lot of things. Yeah, a lot of people write a lot of things in books. But yeah, in heaven, they do gamble. In heaven, they drink, they gamble, they have dancing girls. Because heaven is not a holy place. It's a place for enjoyment. So whatever good karmas you have done, it's like Hawaii multiplied 100 times, like I've told you. So you go there, and that's why our rishis never gave much importance to heaven. They say heaven is not anything to attain. Heaven is what? Whatever pleasures you have on earth, they are multiplied. Okay, you have one woman here, there you can have 100 women. You know, like these people, these Muslims, they say if you die, you get 69 women or whatever. Or you couldn't drink here, there you have unlimited drinks, whatever you want. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can gamble. If you want a big house, they'll have a phenomenal house as big as you want. You want a golf course, you can have a 72-hole golf course. And you can play golf, you know, 7 days a week, 365 days a year because the weather is perfect. There is never rain. So whatever you want, everything is available in heaven. So heaven is a zone of pleasure. Heaven is not something... Heaven is where you enjoy your good karmas. But that's not the goal of human birth. They said the goal of human birth is to realize the self. To realize the self while living, that I am that. To become one with that God. And that is the final. Heaven is a stepping stone. Okay, after I die, I go there for a while. Then I say, okay, now I have to continue my journey. But those who are very evolved, they don't want heaven. They say, why am I going to waste my time here and waste another 1,000 years, you know, enjoying these dancing girls? I don't need that. In fact, Nachiketa in the Kathopanishad, this is a very beautiful Upanishad. If somebody would like to, one Upanishad which has the Bhagavad Gita has taken a lot from it. It's a very beautiful Upanishad. There, the student, the time is passing, but it's okay, we can do next week. But the Kathopanishad is a very beautiful Upanishad. It is said that there, the student was a young boy. This was a young boy about 6-7 years old. And his father was doing a great yajna, a great sacrifice. And in that sacrifice, you are supposed to give everything, whatever you possess. You give away everything to the poor and start afresh. And that's a great sacrifice. You know how I have to give away everything. And so his father does the sacrifice and invites all the poor people and all. But his father gets a little greedy because he says, if I give away everything, what's going to happen? So all the good cows, he sends them away. You know, and he gives away his weak cows, you know, that were dying. And he keeps a lot of his money and gives away a little, you know, like that. So he gets a little greedy. So the boy asks his father, he says, father, he sees that. His boy was very smart. He was quite spiritually evolved. He said, you're giving away everything that you possess. He says, yep, everything I possess, I'm giving away. So he says, then whom are you going to give me to? Because I'm also your possession. I'm your child. I'm your son. So whom are you going to give me to? Because you have to give away everything, right? So where will you give me? Father ignored. It's a little boy. What does he know? And he's busy doing all the rituals and prayer. After a while, again, he goes and holds his. Whom are you going to give me to? He said, shh, be quiet. I'm busy. And third time, he says, you know, whom are you? He pulls him roughly. Whom are you going to give me to? I need an answer. He says, I'm going to give you to death. You know, like you say, no, go to hell. When he got angry, I give you to Lord Death. So the boy says, you gave me to Lord Death? Wonderful. I'm going because my father has given me, right? Has given me away. So he said, now I have to go meet Lord Death. So he goes. It is said that he traveled with his body up to actually hell where this Yamaraj, the god of death, resides. And he says he's said to be a king and has a huge palace. And he was there outside the gate, and happened that Yamraj had gone away for 3 days, I guess to visit somewhere. And so this little boy sleeps outside the gates of the palace for 3 days and three nights, you know, because there is no one to receive him. The gates are closed. So hungry, thirsty. But he said, I have been given to Yamraj. I have to come here. So he waits there. And after 3 days, Yamraj comes and he finds this boy. And he says, oh, how long have you been here? He says, 3 days and nights. He feels so bad. You know, this young boy came to meet me. And also was a Brahmin boy, you know, and there is some, because he was of good birth and all. And in India, of course, guest is considered as God, Atithi Devo Bhava. And my guest has been sleeping outside in the cold in for three nights. So he invites him in and says, I'm very sorry and all that. And then he says, what can I give you? You know, what three boons? Because you spent 3 days and nights. Of course, he feeds him and all. And I can give you three boons. So he says, okay, three boons. He says, yeah. So first boon, he asks for his father, that may my father not be angry with me and may he get the results of his yajna. Mm-hmm. You know, so first boon he asks for his father, even though his father had told him, get out and go to hell. And then the second boon he asks, that teach me the ritual by which I can benefit everybody. So that's why he teaches him that Agni, you know, particular fire ritual, which when it is performed, it is for the welfare of all. So he teaches him that. So he says, now the third wish I want is I want to know what happens after death. Where does a person go? What happens? I want that knowledge. Some people say he lives, some people say he doesn't. So I want that highest knowledge from you. So Yamaraj says, you know, you are a young boy. You know, it's not your age to be learning all this stuff. You know, you need to have fun. You need to grow up. So don't ask me this. He says, look, you promised me, you know, my third boon, and I want it. I demand it. She says, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll give you all the elephants you want and all the wealth you want and all the dancing girls. You can become the king of the earth and you will have these dancing girls around you. And whatever money you want, you will get. Whatever you desire, you will have. Whatever elephant. In those days, elephants and horses were the wealth. So all the anything you want on earth, I can give you. Because I am God. But don't ask me for this knowledge. She says, Yamraj, tell me. These dancing girls and this money and these elephants and these horses, will they stay with me forever? No. Will they give me permanent joy and happiness? No, they can't. So then keep them. Keep them with you. He says, keep your dancing girls and keep your elephants and keep your horses and keep your wealth and keep your kingdoms. I don't want any of that. I asked for that knowledge. I want that. So that was the vairagya, the detachment of that student and his firm-minded conviction that when I am on the right path, I want what I want. And that is the only way to progress spiritually. Swami Tejomayananda ji, who is the head of the mission, and Guru Swami Ishwarananda ji also used this term, pajama personality. You know, most of us are like pajama, the Indian pajamas, which are very loose. You know, they go from side to side, you know, and they're very floppy. He says, do not be a pajama personality. Do not just flop from one to the other. Theek hai, Bhagawan mil gaye to theek hai, nahi mil gaye to bhi theek hai, koi baat nahi. You know, if I get God, it's okay. If I don't get God, doesn't matter. Let me enjoy. He says, be firm in your conviction. And even in the world, if you want to be successful in business or in, you know, in any profession, you want to climb Mount Everest, you want to win the Olympics, you have to have the firm conviction. So that conviction you can see in that student, that I don't care even for the joys of the heavens. You know, I want that highest truth. And so then Yamaraj then sits down and teaches him the knowledge of the who is the self and who is. So very beautiful Upanishad, and the Bhagavad Gita has taken a lot of verses from that. Krishna has taken. So the idea being that these heavens and these joys are okay, I mean, yeah, one has to have some comforts, but that cannot be the goal in life. So that's why heaven has been looked down upon by our rishis. Because they say heaven is just a, you know, pleasure zone. You know, it's like Las Vegas. You go, you can enjoy all the comforts day and night, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. The machines never stop. And you can go anytime and play. So that So that is what heaven is. It's just Las Vegas multiplied 100 times.
When we are took you to the heaven, once it's finished, you come back.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Yeah, shine punye marti loka vishanti. Yes. Yes, sir.
He said that when God made man, he gave him the knowledge of good and evil and also of free will. My question is it possible to be closer to God without having the knowledge of good and evil?
No, knowledge is necessary. Knowledge is...
Are there beings in the universe that don't have the knowledge of good and evil but still have a free will? For example, the angels in the tradition of the Christians.
Well, again, these angels, they say, are these gods and angels are divine beings who were humans, but as a result of their good actions, they became angels and they became even gods, you know, like Zeus and all Indra and all these. So angels and these higher beings are people who have done tremendous amount of good works and maybe even acquired knowledge. But again, that is a temporary zone. They still have to come back to earth to continue their spiritual journey. Even they said Indra, who is the king of gods, had spent 99 years with a human guru to learn. Even though he was king of all the gods and king of heaven, he had to learn. But they say there are different zones. You know, there are seven above, and seven above earth and then six below. So they say the heaven is some of the lower worlds. It's not the highest. Heaven is maybe second or third or whatever above the earth. But then above heaven, there is like Brahma Loka, where the Brahmaji, the creator, lives, or where Vishnu, the Vaikuntha, and all those higher worlds. There, if you reach, if you have done so much good deeds and have acquired so much merit, so there are two kinds of people. One is who realize the truth right here and now. Somebody like Jesus or Buddha or Swami Chinmayananda or Shankaracharya or Guru Nanak. Right in this life itself, they have acquired the highest, and so they don't need to be born again. But suppose you have not acquired the highest, and you have still some amount of knowledge, then some people go to these higher worlds, and where they live there, that's beyond heaven even. They're not even enjoying the joys and sorrows of heaven. Joys of heaven. There in that world, Brahmaji and other great sages teach them. And so these souls can learn and they can evolve to the highest there. They don't need to take birth again. But there are some who right in this life itself, they are finished with their journey. And so then they become one with God and they live with Him forever.
So the humans have a soul, but
yes.
God has no soul.
Oh, no, God is the total soul. All the souls are one. See, the soul, even though we consider it as individual... See, there a soul is misunderstood. There are two ways to use the word soul. One soul is the consciousness or the life. The other soul is the one that goes through rebirth. You know, the meaning of soul has to be understood as to how you're using it. Are you using it as the total consciousness? Then there is only one Atman, one consciousness. And that is the same in all. That one soul, one consciousness. But there are individual souls called the jiva, which is the mind and intellect vasanas, the subtle body. And that is what dies. When the body dies, it drops the body and goes into the higher worlds and enjoys the good or suffers in the lower worlds, the hell. So this subtle body, which is called the soul, some people call that, oh, iski atma ko shanti dena. You know, they say, oh, may his soul rest in peace. You know, they always pray, may his soul, when somebody dies, may his soul rest in peace. Now, if soul is that total consciousness, that is always at peace. But when they say, may his soul rest in peace, what they're talking about is this individuality called the jiva, the mind, intellect, the subtle body, that package. So that package may have, you know, done good or bad karma. So by praying for that individual, you can help that individual too. So when you're talking about soul, you have to be clear which soul you're talking about. There are two meanings.
The power of good and evil.
I'm sorry?
A human being, he has the power to do good or evil because he has a free will and the knowledge of good
and
evil.
Right.
God himself has the knowledge of good and evil and created evil. Does he have the power to sin?
No, he doesn't have the power to sin, and he didn't create evil. He created the world perfect. The world with the animals, birds, fish, and all, everything is perfect. It's all flowing smoothly, symmetrically. Even the viruses, bacteria, they all have a role to play, because the human beings have to be killed and animals. So the viruses, bacteria are necessary. If there were no viruses, we would be alive forever. So he created that. But the good and evil came because of man's good and bad choices. See, he gave man the freedom to choose. He did not create good and evil. He created the world, and the mistake he made that he created man and gave him the choice to choose good and evil. So that it's not a mistake, but it was an experiment. He said, okay, let me see. Let me create a being that has the freedom to choose, and let me see what that being does.
He already knew, of course.
Yeah, he already knew, but it was an experiment. And then so he sent us on this earth, and he said, okay, you have the freedom to choose, and you have the books to, you know, to guide you. Either you follow them and be happy and come to me, or don't follow them and become an evil being and create sorrow, and then you will suffer. So the law of karma is the same for everybody. So, yeah, I don't know. He's not capable of good or evil. The Lord does actually is beyond good and evil. The Lord is beyond good and evil, because good and evil is judged based on our body, mind, and intellect. Like the same action could be good or evil depending on my intention. Like I stab somebody and cut open his stomach. Now, if I'm trying to kill that person, that is evil. But if I'm a surgeon and I'm stabbing him to cut open his belly to take out a gangrenous appendix, I'm doing good. So the same action can be good or evil depending on the intentions. So God has no intentions. He has no good or evil. He's perfect. He's just the creator and the sustainer of the universe, but himself not capable of good or evil.
What does Swami say in the 16th chapter that he does not speak? He said that evil is not a positive factor, but it's an absence of
really supposed to practice one of those values, 26 values. True. Now, because we all have that same spark of consciousness, God is within us, in every one of us. That's why we are walking and talking. The problem is we ignore God, our essential goodness, and go towards evil. And that is choice we make. But then we blame there is some creature called devil who took me away from the path and all. So what you're doing is you're shifting responsibility of your evil actions on some other divine creature called devil who took me away. But actually, it is our wrong choices that we make.
It's like electricity.
Yeah, you are all in me, but I am not in you. Means God supports everything. No, he says, they are in me, I am not in them. I am not in them. Right. No, spark of God is not in us. It is in and out everywhere. God is not only sitting inside as a little spark. He is in and out everywhere. But that divinity is reflected in the mind and intellect. That consciousness which is everywhere. It's not only in us, as people think God is this tiny little light somewhere in the middle. No, God is in and out everywhere. And He is the life in every cell. Every cell of my body is illumined and multiplying because of God's presence. But when we say God is in us, what we mean is God is reflected in the mind and intellect, which is the subtle body. And because of this reflection of the consciousness in the subtle body, my body is able to work. So the subtle body, the mind and intellect, just as the sunlight, when it's reflected in a bucket of water, and the light can reflect into the room, even though the windows are closed, but there is a little small window. The sunlight reflects on the bucket, and the light is then reflected in the room. Now, the bucket is clean or dirty, that will depend. If the bucket is clean, the reflection will be clean. If the bucket is dirty, the reflection will be dirty. Or if there is no bucket, there was a stone, then again the light would not be reflected. So the subtle body has the ability to reflect consciousness. And that is why I am alive, because my subtle body, now depending on the cleanliness, if my subtle body is clean, I become a saint. If my subtle body is dirty, I become a sinner. So that same consciousness is reflected in equally in the saint and in the sinner. It was as much there in Mahatma Gandhi as it was in Hitler. The consciousness is the same. It is how you use the abilities that decides whether you're a good or a bad person. So it's not that God is in us. God is in and outside, everywhere. Antar bahishta tat sarvam vyapta narayana tishtati. God is in and out, everywhere, but is reflected in the human. That's why a stone cannot talk. Why? Because it does not have this subtle body. While you and I have the subtle body, so we can talk. But like a plant only has a mind, does not have an intellect. So that's why the plant can feel emotions. That's why they say if you sing to a plant or play good music, it can grow well. But if you shout at the plant and play rock music, the plants don't grow. They did a study on that. So they have a mind too, but they don't have an intellect. They don't decide, oh, a plant cannot say, I don't feel like growing mangoes. I'm going to grow apples. No, because it is decided by nature. So that is called God is within us. So what he says, they are all in me. And also when he says, I am not in them, what he means is I am not involved in the results of your action. Like an ocean is not involved in whether the wave is born or dying. Like the mud. No, parts are being created and parts are being destroyed, but the mud is not involved. That is the ninth chapter. Actually, you need to read. It's very difficult to explain in a short time, but it's a beautiful, most beautiful chapter, I think, as far as the knowledge is concerned, has the highest knowledge. I say that about every chapter, right? Yes, you had a question.
I was just gonna say that, but you can see that with my dog.
Yes.
My dog has very big emotions and it feels, but has a little. Absolutely,
so, right.
I mean, you can say the thing about the plant, which I believe in, I've right. seen studies, but it would be more easy to, as an example, to see, you know, a dog has feelings
yes.
and emotions.
Right, right. If you beat him or yell at him and all, yes. So they have. So they, as they go up in the evolution, they slowly, like in dolphins and chimpanzees and all, they have more human qualities. They nurture their young and they have socially interact and they even have limited language abilities. So slowly you can see the intellect developing. You know, that's called the evolution. So the mind develops and then they develop an intellect. In humans, it is a fully developed. It's different whether we use it or not. Yeah. Yeah, no, every being continues to evolve till he reaches God. Just like a river, you know, it will go side to side, and if there are obstacles come, it will go around, and there may be problem, but ultimately she merges with the ocean. So each and every one of us is on this spiritual journey. Now, on this journey, you may have ups and downs, like you're climbing the mountain. You know, I mean, suddenly you slip and fall all the way down, and then you start all over again. So some people, because of their karmas, in this particular life, they may not have a chance to evolve, but by going through the sorrows of this life, some of their bad karmas are being exhausted. And so then, of course, in the next life, they will have a chance to progress. Or even this life itself, we find some people born in very bad circumstances. When they meet the right guru, so many of our saints were born in very poor situations and very hardship. Yeah. So they are all they're like a plant. You know, it's just going through its karmas. They're living a vegetable life because of their karmas in their past life. But having exhausted them, once they leave this body, yeah, the journey will continue until you reach the self. That's what the Lord says. I want all of you to come to me. But if you choose not to, then you continue to suffer one after the other lifetime. Punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam. Shankaracharya ji says, yeah.
This one is true that everybody has to reach the God. But in 16th association,
huh? Yeah, I think he said that. But I think, again, what he meant is in that particular life, you cannot, you know, as a dog or a cat. But if you have gone through that life, it's possible that once you give up that life, then you could come back to human. Yeah, I think that is possible. Because like they say, like dogs and cats that are born to saints, where they live with saints or where they live with good music and all, they can. So in that particular life, they may not. But having gone through that life, then the soul's journey will continue, I think. I think what he was trying to be was very dramatic, that don't do that. Then you will. I think it worked. He scared us enough. I think that was the idea, not to make us despair. Huh?
Now that we are human, don't
right. Right. Now that you have become don't. Yeah. So he was just strongly delivering that message. Right. But thank you. Yes.
Yeah.